Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Adam Siegel, who is the Ira A. Lippman Senior Fellow at the Council of Foreign Relations. His new book is Advantage: How American Innovation Can Overcome the Asian Challenge. Adam, welcome to Berkeley.
Thanks for having me.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in Memphis, Tennessee, and lived there until I went off to college.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
My father is originally English, and so I think probably that made sure that I was always kind of thinking about other countries and more internationally, and that was probably reinforced by being in a place like Memphis, which was probably more smaller and more inward-focused.
And what got you interested in international affairs?
I think, you know, traveling to England, also as a child traveling to Israel, where some of my other relatives had moved, made me interested in international affairs. And that's when I went off to college, was what I decided I wanted to do.
And where did you do your undergraduate work?
At Cornell.
And what did you major in?
Government.
Mm-hmm. And then on to graduate school, where did you do your graduate work?
I did a master's at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, and after that, back to Cornell for a PhD.
And what was your work on as a graduate student?
Primarily on Chinese industrial and technological policy. So looking in the end, my dissertation looked at Xi'an, Guangzhou, Beijing, and Shanghai, and how those four cities try to encourage startups in the software and computer industries.
And what did you discover, and how did it provide an insight for the book that we're going to talk about in a minute?
The major discovery of the book was that even though the national government had a standard policy about how they wanted to promote startup companies, each of the localities, each of the municipal governments interpreted that standard policy in their own ways. And that interpretation had a lot to do with not only kind of the physical infrastructure that they had, but a lot of the kind of mental models in their mind about how you encourage development. So, for example, Shanghai in the 90s was very focused on Korea. They thought that was the model. So even though they were supposed to be promoting small startups, they had the idea of the big conglomerates, the chaebol in Korea, the LGs, the Samsungs. And so if you were going to start a company, a new company, Shanghai really wasn't the place to do it, even though we had this vision of Shanghai as being very entrepreneurial and aggressive economically. The influence on this book, I would say, is both this kind of distinction between physical infrastructure and mental models and software and culture and these things, but also, I think, a greater sensitivity to the barriers that policymakers, entrepreneurs in China face as they try to innovate.
Before we talk about the book, I want to ask you about the challenges of being an area specialist, in a sense, knowing the Chinese language, knowing Chinese culture on the one hand, an international relations specialist, and then also a person who may not be a scientist, but who has to be informed about technical innovations. What are the challenges of bringing those three topics together as a place to focus your studies?
Right. I think, you know, on the area studies, international relations policy side, is that you your whole training as an area specialist is in some parts to find the unique in what you're studying and how China in particular differs from the other cases. But of course, to be relevant and to help, you know, knowledge move forward, you have to be able to generalize from that. So I think in China studies in particular, but probably in the other areas as well, that there's always a tendency to kind of draw even finer distinctions. We'll say, well, that's not true for China. And then when you get a group of China specialists together, they say, well, that might be true in Shanghai, but it's not true in Guangzhou or Xi'an. Mm-hmm. And so, well, actually, it might be true in that part of Xi'an, but the part of Xi'an that I studied, it's different than that. So I think that's one kind of issue, is you have to be able to find the unique, but also then, you know, generalize it and make it useful for other people. Coming from not from a technical background, from a not science background, I think you have to be, one, you have to have some humility about what you're doing. You're studying a whole field that you weren't trained in. And you have to, I think, be sensitive to different norms of practice and understanding. And I think really be sensitive to that when you are trying to understand that. And then also realize that your predictions are in some ways blinkered by your lack of understanding about where the field is going.
That is the technology.
The technology side, because so much of this is policymakers trying to respond or shape technology trends, but those technology trends are unknown to most people, and my sense of it is secondhand from people.
So let me show your book again, Advantage. And what was your goal in writing the book?
My original goal was kind of the opposite of what the book turned out. I had written in 2003 or 2004 a piece for Foreign Affairs called Is America Losing Its Edge, which basically wanted to draw attention to what I saw as the ramping up of science and technology capabilities, particularly in China, but more broadly across the region, and how I felt that we were not responding or were being slightly dismissive of the progress that they were making. So that was the original goal. But once I hit the ground, I found that I found a different story.
Mm-hmm. And we're going to talk about that in a minute. And actually, I would like to try to walk you through the salient points of the book. It's a very rich book, a lot of detail, so people will want to go and read it for that. But let's start in terms of the different ways of looking at what's going on with regard to the competition from Asia in policy circles in the United States. On the one hand, what we see through your book is, on the one hand, national security types versus the business community.
Yeah.
How do they see the world of competition differently?
I think on the national security side, it's very clear for the Pentagon and for a large majority of Congress, this is clearly a zero-sum competition. Technological prowess feeds into is a major source of U.S. military advantage, and that's increasingly important as China modernizes its military. And so for them, there is a sense that any increase on the Chinese side and is a decline for the U.S. And the example I give in the book is, if Intel makes a decision to site a new fab in Dalian, that's a loss for the United States and a gain for China. The business community, and here you probably have to distinguish between big business or multinationals and small business, but on the big business side, they are much more likely to see this as win-win, that you're growing the pie and everyone's going to benefit. And that's because they are so very well positioned to take advantage of that, right? New research in China, new scientists, they have the capabilities to set up an R&D lab in China and leverage those new skills.
And importantly for the latter group, this is a point that really stands out in your book, big business needs to be in China and have its ear to the ground with regard to changes in technology as a larger and larger market develops there.
Exactly right. So they're driven by many reasons, and one of them is the search for talent and new ideas. But the main reason they go now is that they believe that future markets are there, and they're probably right given growth. Growth rates. So the concern for them, or the main issue for them, is to be close to those markets and to understand what those markets want.
You have a figure there, the size of the size of the market for online access.
Right.
In China. Do you recall that number? I mean,
Well, the number I probably gave is probably out of date now because I probably gave a number of around 280 million, but the number now, the most recent number is 450 million Chinese online. And if you look at cell phones, you know, the Chinese cell phone market is about 700 million, I think. So you're talking about a massive market.
And it's a market that large corporations have to be in tune with if they're going to be on top of the developments that sort of emerge as a result of that market.
That's right. And it's, they're not only large markets, but they're becoming increasingly sophisticated markets. So, you know, in the beginning stages of reform, the Chinese consumer was just happy to have anything, right, because they came from such a period of privation. But now, you know, they want to make sure that their cell phones are the most up-to-date, that they're either iPhones or competing with iPhones. And so for the especially for those producers in what you know, essentially are commodities, right? Cell phones and PCs these days. They have to be very close to those consumers.
Now, in the book, you told us you started out thinking, oh, dear, how are we going to deal with this competition? But your thinking evolved as you did the research. And to comprehend the complexities here, you set up a series of dualities
right.
that are quite interesting. And really, the first one is what you call hardware versus software. And tell us what those two things are and how having that analytic concept changed your thinking
right.
about what was going on?
Well, the hardware, I think, is the one we pay the most attention to, and I think is the one that's most immediately available to people because it's the easiest to measure. So think about hardware, we can think about all these metrics, how many patents these countries are producing, how many papers, how many scientists and engineers they're publishing, what are the investments in R&D. Those are the things that have kind of dominated our picture of what's going on in China, in particular, but Asia more broadly. Spending is going up. There are more scientists and engineers. So that's the hardware. The software are the social and political and cultural understandings and institutions that make the whole greater than the sum of its parts. So they help take an idea from the lab to the marketplace. And these are the things that are much harder to measure but are critically important. How do you actually train a scientist? What skills do they have? Does a professor have the right to commercialize the technology him or herself? What kind of transparency exists? And so increasingly, part of that duality came from what I heard from the Chinese themselves, which is that we've invested a lot of money. We're not getting what we want out of the system.
And so in the end, when you make this comparison, then you come to realize that just looking at the numbers are not enough.
Right.
And so what that means is that if we know that creativity comes from a decentralized setting where the individual scientist or entrepreneur has the ability to challenge his superiors or to challenge his teachers, that's an important ingredient that is part of what you're calling the software.
Right. Those things are much harder to build and develop, right? A culture that basically says, well, yes, the most junior scientist in the lab has the right to challenge the most senior scientist in the lab. Or if they have a good idea, we're going to encourage that person to go off on a new tangent, even if they may fail. We're going to disperse the research money based on the strength of the ideas. And those things are just, they're not there yet. The Chinese policymakers, Indian policymakers, Korean policymakers, they know that that's a problem, but they're just not there yet. And so a very prominent Chinese biologist said, you know, to build a lab takes 2 years, but to actually have the lab produce results may take 2 decades while we create these new skills.
Mm-hmm. Now, you make another important point. You say at one point, innovation is a social and political process. So first of all, explain to us what you mean by what you see as innovation,
right.
Please.
There's a huge debate about what innovation is and what, the literature on innovation is massive. I'm talking about a very narrow set of innovations. I am talking about what people generally refer to as science-based, new-to-the-world product innovation. So you know, the breakthrough in the lab that creates an entirely new industry or entirely new product. What China and India have tended to excel in for the last two decades is what people call process innovation. Taking a given design, generally from the West or from Japan, and then either producing that more cheaply or more quickly, or developing new ways to deliver it more cheaply and more quickly. So I'm talking about a very narrow spectrum of innovation, basically what we think of kind of the eureka moment.
Mm-hmm. And but in terms of the challenge of competition, you have to be able to do all the things.
That's right.
Right.
Yeah, they're all intimately connected. So there are, you know, there's these also these ongoing debates about which are more important to the economy. In fact, there's a great deal of evidence that the process side and the diffusion. We don't even talk about diffusion, right? It's not. It's also not only the person that invents the computer, but how do companies then use it for their own business processes. And so the U.S. economy has been incredibly efficient on the diffusion side, on using that. And you can look at the Japanese economy by comparison, actually has been much, much, much less efficient on diffusion of IT and use by small businesses. But the overall health of an economy, of course, relies on the interaction of all three of these steps, innovation, absorption, diffusion. And it's very hard to say, well, you can only have one without the other.
Mm-hmm. Now, you went on to say that innovation is a social and political process. Mm-hmm. What does that mean for competition?
Well, for the social, you know, that focuses on a lot of what we should be doing to encourage that, and China and India should be doing as well. But the social means that, you know, the vision of the scientist alone in their lab with the breakthrough is a myth. That scientists innovate in groups through a process of interaction with their colleagues. Often in these very tightly held networks spread through universities and internationally. And so on the policy side, that means you want to create environments and produce these institutions that encourage this type of social framework. So on the U.S. side, there's been a lot of talk about creating scientists, which I think, you know, is a fine discussion to have. But I'm more interested in, well, once we've created that scientist, are they plugged into these networks? On the political side, especially when we were talking about Asia, about the ability to challenge authority, free flow of information, all of these have to do about the role of the Communist Party in Chinese society.
Mm-hmm. Now, in the world of the Cold War, this was an easier issue to address. Why was that the case? Why was it a cleaner world in terms of the topics we're discussing?
Well, in some ways, the larger issue was the same. Even in the Cold War, we had this debate about how to keep ahead of the Soviets. And the debate basically split along the lines of, we can keep ahead of the Soviets by running faster than they do, and the main way we do that is remain open, or we can keep ahead of the Soviets by hiding our secrets and basically remaining tight control. That debate actually continues today. But the U.S. economy and the Soviet economy were two separate things. You know, something 1% of GDP came from trade between the two sides. It was a minuscule amount, very little connections, and it was very easy to identify who we thought was a Soviet spy for the most part. That's impossible now with the Chinese economy, given that they're both are. You know, second largest trading partner, or large trading partner.
It's about 14%.
14%,
right?
And also a potential competitor. It's impossible to talk about certain sectors in information technology and say, well, this is the American part of it and this is the Chinese part of it. An American company is sourcing from China, which may be doing R&D in Taiwan. It's all way, way too interdependent. And the presence of Chinese PhD students, master students in American labs and universities is a main source of the dynamism of the American innovation system. So the two systems are so tightly interconnected, it would be impossible to draw a line between them.
So the problem of openness is on an entirely different plane in today's globalized world.
Yes, it's what I call the paradox of openness is that it's both a major threat to our security and the ultimate guarantee of it. In that the openness clearly, the Chinese People's Liberation Army, the Chinese military clearly benefits from the openness. We've seen a massive diffusion of technology. Some of it just through buying it on the open market, but a lot of it through conventional espionage or cyber espionage or other things. But the U.S. military technological superiority is dependent on our innovation system, which is dependent on openness. So there's no way to kind of think about really shutting ourselves off to the world without hurting ourselves.
Now, the second distinction you make is between a globalized world and the empowerment that comes from acting locally. Now, in the Cold War world, it was probably seen as a virtue what Asian governments can do. I mean, you enumerate them. The governments there can support national champions, industrial champions. They can protect domestic industrial sectors, and they can purchase strategic assets abroad, especially with all the reserves they have in the sovereign funds. But that's trickier in today's world. Those were all pluses in the world of the Cold War. But why is it trickier now?
Well, because now these basically production is no longer co-determinant with national boundaries. Right? It's very hard for any industry to think, well, we're going to do all of it, any part of it. And so all of this is now global. Production chains are all global. And you have to source in different localities where the comparative advantage is. So even if you wanted to put it all together, you would then be in fact putting yourself at a competitive disadvantage, because it may be that piece is best done in Sweden as opposed to at home. So it's very hard for national government. National governments always want to think about boundaries, right? They always want to think about territories and where are things located. But because of the communications revolution and because of this spread of production, that's not how business thinks.
Mm-hmm. This notion, you've explained to us what works in a globalized world, but let's talk a little about local initiatives and ask, well, who's better positioned? Now, you in your dissertation work, you found that different regions in China responded differently to directives. How does that compare with what is happening here, and why does it matter in terms of the global versus the local?
Well, because I think on this distinction global-local, we've overemphasized the global, right? With globalization, we were all so focused on what was new, right? And we all knew the kind of truisms became, you know, distance is dead, and you can locate anywhere, and you can produce things anywhere. And so whatever can move, whatever isn't bolted down, will move. But that's not exactly true. It turns out that, you know, to use the competing metaphors, the world isn't really flat. It's spiky. There are certain geographies or regions that provide a wealth of both kind of talent and knowledge and these networks that tie all these things together. And that's where companies want to be, right? They don't want to be out in the middle of nowhere. They want to be somewhere where they can plug into these connections.
So an area like the Bay Area, exactly. Silicon Valley, Stanford and Berkeley and
Austin,
venture capitals.
Austin, Route 128 in Boston, Research Triangle Park in North Carolina, San Diego, all these places that kind of have these models like the Bay Area, venture capital, universities, startups, and big companies all located together. And so, of course, lots of places have tried to create these. And this is the difficult problem. How do you recreate this process, which no one has really figured out? There's no mystery sauce, right? You can't put it all together and automatically get it. But this is increasingly the way that regions have to compete. You have to think about what it is that we are, what our competitive advantage is, and what can we do to make sure that all of this is sticky, right? Because it's not enough just to have a university that's producing innovations or new breakthroughs, because any company can take those and then locate them and manufacture in Asia. you want to make sure that the manufacturing, the new company creation is all happening locally. And so that takes a regional effort. That takes local leaders, business leaders, university leaders saying, well, where do we think the most growth is going to be? What do we need? Is there a should the community college be training people in specific skills? Do we have enough startup capital? Those kind of questions.
Mm-hmm. And in your book, to talk about an American case study, you talk about the state of Arizona.
Right.
Under Governor, then Governor Napolitano,
yeah.
There was an effort. Talk
yeah.
a little about that, and how does that develop over time
right.
in a way?
Well, right now it's an unknown outcome. So as you mentioned, under Governor Napolitano, but driven by business leaders and also by Michael Crow, the president of ASU, of Arizona State, had this vision of. The old model was broken, right? Basically, Phoenix in particular, but Arizona more generally, its growth was based on growth, right? People moving to the region and real estate, which was created a very high rate of growth. Phoenix is the fifth or sixth largest city in the country, and growing faster. But it also created these massive boom and bust cycles. Particularly, we saw with the real estate bust. So the idea was. We need to get out of this. We need to create a growth model. And so business leaders, university leaders, and the state leaders said, well, we need to start helping startups. And so they picked biotech, which is a big bet. Biotech is a hard industry to push forward. And so began to think about, well, who do we need to get to come here, and what do we need to help those things grow? And right now it's uncertain. The state budget crunch has really hurt funding both for the university and for the Science Fund of Arizona. And there's, as I mentioned, biotech is a difficult industry to get into. So there's a question about should they refocus now on solar?
Mm-hmm. So this is an interesting conundrum because you start on this work with the assumption, oh, things are really bad. You reach a level of insight, you said, where you're saying, well, it's more complicated than I thought. Then, of course, we get the 2008 economic collapse and a political environment
right.
in which the role of government is being questioned. Everybody has to cut back on budgets and so on. What in your view will lead us for you to have another level of
yeah.
optimism? What is the key ingredient
yeah.
here? The governments
yeah.
with some budgets to be able to at least light a match to get these things going?
Yeah, I think the optimism comes from that most of this, the government is playing a supportive role. They're not playing an initiating role. And that most of the energy for this comes from local business and university leaders. And so on that front, I'm more optimistic. I think, it's easier to get things done at that level, and that, especially that's one of the major strengths of the U.S. system is that universities have played such a huge role in driving economic development, and the connections, right, the between business and university leaders is so strong in our country. So I have some optimism that while the state legislatures are not going to be particularly helpful right now, they're not going to get in the way that there's some of that. And then the other is that, yes, budgets are going to be an issue, and you can't do any of this without money. But for a lot of these things, it's not a lot of money. The other example that I talk about in the book is the case of Maine, right? And in that case, setting up the initiative built around these new wood composites was $15 million. So we're not talking about a huge amount of money. And the focus on the social side of it means, it's not all about building these new labs. It has to happen, but it's also about these other more process-oriented.
Now it's interesting because at this very time, and we're talking about this, the focus is on jobs,
yeah.
jobs. And there is a sense from the supporters of labor that the processes you're describing are making jobs in places like China and India but not here. Yeah. That's the perception. So how does this need for openness affect the challenge of creating jobs in the United States, given our present economic environment?
Yeah. I mean, there's a big focus in the book, and I think right, and you know, you can see this also coming up in the president's recent comments on new startups. You know, the largest engine of job creation in the U.S. over the last decade and more has been small companies, and not just small companies, new small companies. They've driven job creation. So there's a lot that needs to be done to help those companies. Because new companies, the biggest problem they face is access to capital. So the phrase is, you know, the valley of death. After you start up, how do you get past what generally are we call the three Fs, friends, family, and fools who give you the money? How do you get more money to start scaling up? So there's that issue has to be addressed. That, I think, is the primary way that you're going to start focusing on that. But it's a major issue, and one that right now is there's no solution to, in the sense that there's going to be a lot of experimentation. You know, the case in Massachusetts where the local government gave all these subsidies to the solar tech panel manufacturer, eventually they could not compete with China, and those jobs were lost. So it's going to be a constant process of painful churn that people are going to have to really be much more flexible and reactive to.
But what, you know, what? How do we define this in terms of the political arena? Because you move toward providing subsidies or focusing on solar panels,
right,
and trying to cut the cost of having them made here. And then people start screaming industrial policy, socialism,
right,
you know, and so on. Is there a problem with public education here or what?
I think so. And I think what I am promoting is not focused on specific technologies. I focus much more on platforms, right? How do you make sure that new companies, no matter what sector they're in, can get access to capital for these good ideas? And so then you would perhaps have these cases where solar companies would still go out of business, but you would have much less kind of pick the winner industrial policy kind of problems. But yes, the larger debate about what role our government can play in helping these industries is one that we need to have, right? And you can see it already in the debate over the State of the Union, right? The president talked about investments. Republicans countered and said, well, no, this is just spending. This is just expenditures. And so I think the president really needs to explain that these are investments and that they're going to benefit a wide range of people, right? They're not just for scientists. They're not just for startups.
How, if we look now at places like China and India, do you grade them in terms of your concepts, the software versus the hardware, the global versus the local, clearly we've already discussed the way the social and the political and the cultural impinge in a negative way.
Yeah.
What do they have going for them?
Well, I think in the Indian case, actually, the software is growing in some ways faster than the hardware. The Indians, you know, as anyone who's ever been to India knows, right, the infrastructure is a massive problem. And by that I mean real infrastructure, you know, real hardware, the ports, the highways, the airports. That's starting to come along, but not anywhere near the pace that it has to happen. But if you look at the software, you know, the growth of Indian business networks, the role of business plan competitions, you know, every Indian entrepreneur that I interviewed would say, well, you know, I teach a class at this university, and then I coach these two business plan teams over here, and I have all these other networks. Chinese entrepreneurs never told me about that. They weren't involved in anything besides their business. So on the Indian side, I think the software is coming along pretty quickly. It's the hardware side that I think is more of a problem. The Chinese side is the reverse. I think, you know, the hardware is coming along massively. The software is coming, but it's coming more slowly. The interesting thing also on the global local is that we now see Indian and Chinese firms looking for acquisitions abroad on the technology side. The first wave of acquisitions for both those companies, for both of those countries, were primarily resources and big older industries. But the Indians are now farther along on acquiring technology companies. The Chinese are just starting. That's going to be an interesting question as they come into the United States because of the security concerns we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. So is India better placed? We know it is because of its the English language.
Right.
It just the fortuna intervenes here. But in terms of the fact that they are a democracy with vibrant institutions, because the bottom line here seems to be that until China makes the change to democracy, can it come to the sweet spot that it needs to be at? In other words, can you have the Communist Party
right.
still in charge and reach your ideal of localism interfacing with globalization?
I don't know if China needs to move to a full democracy. I think it needs to achieve a higher level of transparency, accountability, and rule of law. So far it seems as if the group that have been damaged the most by Google pulling out of the Chinese market are not, you know, Chinese internet users. They can, those who wanted access to that information could already get it by getting around the circuit, but the censorship technology, and the most users just want to, you know, search for the things that we search for. The people that seem to have been most hurt are scientists. They were using Google Scholar. They were using Google Docs to cooperate with their colleagues abroad. So I think in the short term, no, the Chinese are hurting themselves with these political and controls, free flow of information. Can they create a system that's more flexible and open and get the level of innovation that they want? Probably. I don't think it has to be a full democracy. The Indians, I think, are better set off on the software side, but I think infrastructure is a major problem for China, for India. And, you know, India has this huge advantage of this demographic dividend, right? They're going to have all of these people under 25 years old, but you have to create jobs for those people. And most of those jobs will need to come in manufacturing. And if you can't do that, then India's future looks much less bright.
Mm-hmm. Now, as somebody who's worked at the Council on the Modernization of the Chinese military, mm-hmm. Let's talk a little about that. How much do we have to worry about all of this coming together for China, and we've explored the difficulties,
yeah.
and impacting on our security relations with them?
Well, you can see a growing worry, right? We just had the recent case of Secretary Gates' visit to China. The Chinese roll out the J-20, which looks to be like a stealth fighter. We're not sure how stealth it really is or what its capabilities are, but it raises the question about how quickly the Chinese are modernizing and how robust the technological gap is for the United States. The issue with the military, though, is that the Chinese don't actually have to become exact competitors with us. They don't have to be as militarily capable as we are. We can see already in Iraq and Afghanistan that a determined opponent using asymmetric strategies trying to attack U.S. technological capabilities can do a lot of damage. And so we can see that most of the things that the Chinese are trying to develop, cyberspace, anti-satellite weapons, missiles that can hit a U.S. carrier group, are all focused on these U.S. strengths and are all asymmetric strategies.
Mm-hmm. And is there can you give us a particular example of where the fact that something is being manufactured in China, a device, a circuit board, or whatever, could pose a potential threat if we're trying to move our forces in a show of strength in the Taiwan Straits? I mean, is this just fear-mongering, or is it something that a strategist
right.
really needs to worry about?
No, this is seems to be a real challenge of the globalization of production, is that U.S. technology producers source locally, and then those products end up in the Defense Department. So we've already had cases of counterfeit chips of semiconductors that have showed up in the cockpits of F-16s and F-15s. And so the fear is that you can't reverse engineer the you can't know if those chips have been tampered or not. So the fear is that you get into a conflict situation and the chip turns itself off or does something that it's not supposed to do. There's a very specific case of one of the things the U.S. is most concerned about is submarines. In a case of a Taiwan scenario, the U.S. would send a carrier group into this, into or around the straits to deter the Chinese. And we want to know where those Chinese submarines are. And one of the ways we listen for them are through sonobuoys, basically devices that send out sonar beams to try to figure out what the sonars are. The boards, the circuit boards of those sonobuoys are manufactured in China. So the question is, well, if you were a Chinese military planner, would you try to tamper with those? So that's a huge source of dependence for the United States, and one that we're trying to figure out how do we deal? How do you, again, maintain this open system that gives us our technological edge and reduce this vulnerability?
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of moving beyond the security area, you talk about ways that we can address the challenges posed by India and China, and you have a menu of options: dialogue, cooperation. What do you see happening there, and how will that play out?
Well, it differs immensely from each case. Right? You can see the dialogue around India is all about cooperation. Right? We want to expand our cooperation with the Indians as much as we can. We've removed most of the technology controls on China. On India. And so on that, I'm pretty optimistic that we're going to find a whole range of areas where we can work together, not only on the civilian side but on the military side. China is a different case. Not only do we have this issue about just the military and the security dependence, but on the commercial, on the private side, we're competing with China on technology. And the way that the Chinese are competing these days, we're not happy with, right? So the Chinese are increasingly intervening in markets. They're using procurement strategies. They're using standards. All of these things come under the rubric of what the Chinese call indigenous innovation. They want to reduce their dependence on the West. And so this has meant that they've thrown up a whole range of policies that the U.S. is fighting. How we fight has differed. We've partnered with the Europeans and the Japanese. We've taken the quiet approach. We've taken the loud approach, all of which have been, some have been. We gained a success at the summit with President Hu, but lots of cases there's been backsliding.
Mm-hmm. You offer a solution which you call the wedge,
right,
which seems to actually draw on your dissertation work.
Right.
And explain that to us, because it's kind of interesting. So that there is a component of a decentralized,
yeah,
structure in China that we may want to respond to.
Well, I think I throughout this discussion, we've been using China as a kind of unitary actor, and policy-wise, we tend to think of China as a kind of big single actor with all the same interests. But once you dig down, you realize that of course, different individuals have different interests, different ministries have different interests, and even different sectors, industrial sectors, have different interests. And so you can see especially in the IT and biotech sectors, that a lot of the big players, the big companies, are already global companies, right? And so they have a stake in open access to those global markets. They don't necessarily have a stake in China having its own standards. And so what you want to do, what you want to try to do for the U.S. government from policy thinking is, where are these gaps between either different bureaucracies or big companies, small companies, and how can we try to force space into that, shove a wedge in between them and try to shape the dialogue inside of China in ways that the people that have these views of a more open market win these debates.
And it's a double-edged sword. You point out that one of the problems with intellectual property rights is that local governments have an incentive to have their development figures very high,
right,
which could lead to stealing our intellectual property. So it's a mixed bag,
right,
but we have to know what the target is, you're saying.
That's right. And you know, even in that example, there are some local governments now that are thinking, well, actually, we can encourage a higher rate of growth by being known as the area that protects intellectual property rights. And Dalian in the Northeast is a great example, because they're trying to build an outsourcing and offshoring industry, software offshoring. So they have a real strong incentive to protect intellectual property rights. And so U.S. policymakers and U.S. businesses should be thinking about, well, how do we reward those players that are pushing in that direction?
Mm-hmm. You use the term toward the end of the book of, we can see ourselves, and we should see ourselves as a smart grid. What is a smart grid, and how does it help us understand what we've been talking about?
Well, a smart grid is a power grid that just doesn't send out electricity, you know, when it's there. It thinks, it monitors where the demand is, and also can feed in. So if I have solar panels on my house, and I'm producing more electricity than I need for that day, I can sell it back into the grid. So there's a kind of flow back in and out. And so when I think about applying that image to the United States, is that, you know, we've typically thought of ourselves as the science and technology power. You know, we sign these scientific cooperation agreements with other countries, but it was kind of an act of, you know, noblesse oblige, or, you know, well, here we're going to give you this technology and you're going to use it locally. But we have to reimagine it's not just sending a technology out. We have to know what's going on in these localities, and we have to think about how do we get it back into the United States and use it locally. And so one of the things that I think it matters both on a policy side means that, you know, making sure the flow into the United States of people and ideas remains open, so visas and things like that. But also on an education side, you know, there's a huge push for, you know, scientists and others to have multidisciplinary back training, but we should also make sure that they have international training. Do they spend time abroad? Do they go to a lab for a little bit of their training overseas?
Mm-hmm. And so that if we see ourselves as a smart grid here, then we can use all of our strengths to compete with Asia on the one hand, but also I think you're saying to transcend our notion of national security that comes out of the Cold War, because every student isn't a spy,
right.
Every businessman from abroad is not a threat to our national security, but actually potentially could contribute to that.
Exactly. I think, you know, part of what the smart grid image does is kind of get you out of the zero-sum competition sense and give you a sense that, no, in fact, you know, breakthroughs in other places don't, you know, should make us all better off. In fact, the U.S., if it is a smart grid, should be incredibly well positioned to take advantage of those and isn't necessarily a threat to us, either security or on the economic side.
If we apply your social and political weight as influencing places like India and China, that is their traditions, their culture, and so on, I am coming to a pessimistic point, which is that some of our political and cultural and social traditions cut the other way also. On the one hand, they're very supportive of the smart grid, but on the other hand, they seem not to have the flexibility, yep, the nimbleness that you're saying we really need,
right,
if we're going to do national security / competitiveness.
Yeah, I think, you know, it's going to take a lot of work to make sure that we always fall on the better side of our natures. Right? There's no doubt that you know, we can also be isolationist and xenophobic and use security as a either scaremongering or kind of inwardly focused. You know, and lots of times our leadership isn't up to framing it that way. So yes, it's going to take some work to make sure that we fall on the more open, flexible, nimble side. But I do have confidence that we are capable of it, and I have confidence that there are lots of people that are thinking that way and pushing us that way.
A question I like to ask toward the end of these interviews is, how would you advise students to prepare for the future? Yeah. Obviously, study Chinese right. in your case, but beyond that, because I think you're saying in a way that what seems like the right path or the easy the path that seems clear on the one hand may actually be different. It's a little more complex.
I do. I think, I mean, this is already true with the students that I see that come apply to work at the council or other places, that they already seem so much more accomplished than I was at that age than they are. And they already have a wealth of background. So I think a lot of people are already thinking this way, but it's that you have to master so many more areas. You know, it's not enough to speak Chinese and be a political scientist. You also have to, you know, have some understanding of technical issues. You have to be able to draw on other disciplines and ideas. So I think, you know, the future world is multidisciplinary and it's international. So I think that to the extent that you position yourself at the nexus of these either technical areas that draw on social science insights or the other way around, social sciences that draw on technical expertise, then you're positioning yourself.
And from a government perspective, you point out that the notion, oh, well, here's a new field, biotech, computer sciences, we need to produce more PhDs, and if we have more PhDs, then you know we will solve our problems.
Yeah.
But you're putting up a red flag on that.
Notion. Yeah, I mean, I think on the sciences side, right? We've been predicting shortages since Sputnik for the last six decades, and every decade the salaries in the sciences have been flat, if not been depressed. And PhD students have always had difficulty finding jobs, especially in many of the scientific fields. So I think a lot of, for people that are interested in the sciences, which is already happening, that PhDs are not as attractive. But there's lots that one can do in the world without a PhD. And I think, you know, there are programs now that are thinking about, well, how do you continue with a science career and more science education, but not do a PhD, professional master's in sciences. And these degrees do this. They draw more on business. They draw on anthropology. And so I think that is we're going to see a growth in those areas.
Mm-hmm. In terms of U.S. policy, are there any particular things that you would like to see happen to move us over this threshold where we seem to be stuck right now? And your book is mapping, you know, things that we have to do. Now I'm tapping your insight as a political scientist,
right,
a person who studies politics. What would you like to see happen in the short term?
Well, I think the President's State of the Union actually was an important first step. You know, he basically laid out the problem. And I think started to lay out some of the solutions. I think continuing that discussion on a political level is going to be the difficult thing. And so I think the most immediate thing is this issue we discussed earlier, this divide over investment versus spending or expenditures. That I really think we have to have a serious discussion about. And the rest of the stuff, you know, a lot of it I don't think needs to come from Washington. I think it has to come from the local level. And I think the debate needs to happen, the discussion needs to happen. Say, well, why are we cutting this or why are we spending on this? And so those, I think, are probably the primary short-term thing. I think the other really important thing is just convince people that this is actually going to make their lives better. I think there's a sense that these things matter to scientists or to PhD students or, you know, to the venture capital guys in Sand Hill Road. But we have to be able to sell that to people and say, no, this is, you know, this is going to make your life better too.
And in the end, the hope here is that their jobs will come out of this and they will be American jobs.
Exactly. I think the hope is that, you know, good jobs locally, that people, you know, have a sense that they can tap into all of this.
And it's the startups and the small companies that are the key to that.
Yes. So startups and new startups are the main engine of job growth. they need to have big companies around. Big companies buy small companies. Big companies, small companies sell to big companies, and the other way around. But yes, right now I think the focus. I'm not worried about Intel and Microsoft, Apple. They're going to do fine. I think we should be focusing on the smaller companies.
Well, on that note, Adam, I want to thank you for being here. Let me show your book again. It's a good read, and there was a limit to what we could cover in our conversation today. But thank you very much for writing the book and for coming to Berkeley.
Thanks so much for having me.
Thank you, and thank you for joining us for Conversations with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.